Hello and welcome to the Sports Love Podcast, where we talk about how technology is impacting the worlds of media and sports. Today we're going to take a deep dive into one of the most innovative new platforms to come on the world of sports properties in the last few years. But before we get into that, as ever, I am very pleased to welcome the grandee, grand vizier, fabulous forehead and brain of Sports Loft, Charlie Greenwood. Charlie, how you doing? How's your week been?
That's forehead. That's a new one.
big brain. Big that's brain. Where I'm going with that.
Big brain. Great to be here, Yanni, as always. Very much looking forward to this. This should be really cool.
Yeah, very excited about this. We have with us one of the foremost thinkers and doers in the world of sports business. We're going to talk about the Professional Triathletes Organization and its new T100 Triathlon World Tour Series. And to do so, we've got the fantastic Sam Renouf, who is the CEO of the Professional Triathletes Organization. Sam is a former triathlete himself. Insane. I don't know why anybody would do that, but you know, he is, which is fantastic. And he's headed up PTO, which is the not-for-profit entity representing the body of professional triathletes since 2019. And in that time, the organization has done a hell of a lot that we're really going to get into, including the recent announcement that they've partnered with World Triathlon. And World Triathlon has designated the T100 Triathlon World Tour as the official world championship of tour long-distance triathlon. So that's exciting. We'll dive into that. But also a lot of the stuff that PTO has been doing in terms of the development of its media product, its athlete and participation product, and its global footprint. So Sam, welcome to the Sports Loft Podcast. Fantastic to have you on.
Thank you, and good evening from Australia. So opposite end of the world from you guys this evening, but very glad to be here. And with that introduction, I don't think I need to say much, right? You've done it all for me, so perfect.
I mean, that introduction leaves enough to be jealous of, and then you had to throw in the fact that you're in Byron Bay right now, enjoying the sound of lapping waves and surely some strong sun in the morning. So thanks for that. As we always start, we'll start with the favorite sports moment of the week. And I'll permit myself to go first on this one real quick because it's a slightly left field one. I found myself for the first time in my life submitting an NCAA college basketball bracket for only the women's bracket, because I found myself knowing more about the women's college basketball teams and players than I did about the men's. I knew very, very little about the men's because I've been following it and I've been seeing the explosion of women's sports generally, but specifically Caitlin Clark and Juju Smith-Schuster and like all of these incredible athletes. And so for the first time in my life, I've submitted a NCAA women's college bracket and not a men's one. So I'm really looking forward to following that and seeing how that goes. And in fact, that is not my favorite moment of the week. My favorite moment of the week was actually discussing it with a friend of mine who's done exactly the same thing. Another friend who's submitted only a women's one and not a men's one. So that kind of drove home where the direction of the sports world is going. And I know that there'll be a lot to discuss with you, Sam, about you know your guys' approach to gender equality and how you focus on the women's side of the sport as well. So over to you, Sam. What was your favorite sporting moment of the week?
And so, yeah, look, when I heard about this question, I was totally thrown because I must admit, so I'm down in Australia, mainly working on hosting, right? So we'd like to have an event here as part of the T100. But what it's meant is that I've worked all day on hosting and then each night I've been on the phone basically with the UK team the whole time. So I don't think I've even looked at a newspaper, let alone watch sport. Now, that said, a more exciting moment for me personally was this week, my baby daughter, who is 16 months old, properly started walking. The first time I'm down on the beach in Byron Bay.
Yes.
At a sporting moment, that's the athlete in the making. I'm not sure if she'll be a triathlete or not, but we've got some wobbling potential.
Excellent. Did she start to dip her toe in the water as well, taking two of the three sports down in one go?
Oh, they're already a very passionate swimmer. She's a twin, and the other twin has been walking already for a couple of months. We've been waiting, going, come on, like catch up. And so it was quite a big moment for us as we see her hobble along the beach in beautiful Byron Bay, as you said. What a tough life.
It'll be fun watching them compete with each other as they grow up, won't it? That's fun. It's going to be great.
By the way, fun, but yeah.
Charlie, I shall not ask you about the weekly Wolves update because I don't think it's a brilliant one after the FA Cup. Was it quarterfinals? So moving swiftly away from Wolves, what was your favourite moment of the sporting week?
I've no idea what you're talking about with Wolves, Yanni. It didn't happen. It has been erased from my memory. Probably, hopefully, the expletives that I uttered in front of my children has also been hopefully erased from their memory at that particular moment. My favourite sporting moment of the week actually hasn't happened yet. It's tomorrow night, but the build up to it has. So, we are going to the England Brazil game at Wembley tomorrow night, and taking my wife and my two kids. And the reason that we're going is that it is my youngest's Barnaby's 8th birthday. So it's his birthday present is going to Wembley for the first time. So the walk up Wembley Way and seeing Brazil at home is not a bad first trip to Wembley for you. But the bit that actually I think is a little bit more sort of in keeping with the idea of a sports business podcast is the moment that we basically gave him a piece of an envelope to open, and he opened it, and inside was a piece of paper saying, 4 tickets to Wembley. The look on his face of absolute joy as he kind of registered it was absolutely priceless. And so when you hear about people saying that kids aren't interested in big sporting moments, that, you know, it's all about just specifically a short form video and stuff, of which he watches loads of short form video, that moment of excitement of I'm going to Wembley, I'm going to watch England was just huge. And kind of reinforced actually the real passion that that this whole business invokes around people.
Absolutely. It's brilliant to see and fantastic to hear from both of you that the kids are getting involved in participation and in enjoyment and following of sports, because that is what we are here to discuss. We're here to discuss how we can harness that and how technology can help harness that passion and grow the business. So let's set the scene a little bit. I know a lot of people will be familiar with the Professional Triathletes Organization and what you guys have done, but some may not be quite so familiar. Some may not quite understand the difference between World Triathlon, PTO, and other competing triathlon organizations, or shall we say, other triathlon organizations, doesn't need to be competitive. So, Sam, why don't you just set the scene a little bit for us? Tell us about, you know, how PTO came together and then the business growth, and then we can dive into the T100.
Sure. Great. Happy to. It's a relatively short story, but it's one that has been played out in many sports before. So six or seven years ago, the best professional athletes got together and said, we need to have a greater role in our sport. And that's both an economic role and a governance role and being involved. And it's what we refer to as the path of athlete self-determination, where, you know, it happens in every single professional sport. There is a moment, once it's matured to a certain point, as much from economics as it is from history, that the professionals take a greater role. And that could be from a breakaway organization like, you know, the PGA Tour is ultimately a breakaway from the original PGA, as I'm sure you would know, but most people don't, right? They just think of it as the PGA. The ATP, obviously, that is another one, or it's a union or a collective bargaining agreement, but there's always a moment in sports journey when that happens. And it just happens to be that triathlon's a relatively young sport. It only made the Olympics in 2000. And so triathletes' moment of organizing came in 2018, 2019. The athletes formed a union originally, but then had some very good advice from some people predating me that were sort of helping the athletes get started and said, look, you're in an amazing aspirational sport. This is like golf. So don't create a union, which is just going to complain to folks. Own your own economics, make your own tour, make your own organization. And that's really how the PTO came to be. We are very much modeled after the PGA Tour and the ATP. And our goal is to create our own world tour. We have a unique model in that we are the athlete's body. And you know, get onto this in a second. Athlete's body, like so many other sports, the difference is because we were started in 2020, from a commercial perspective, rather than the 1960s, we didn't have, you know, Mark McCormack running around doing deals and checks like the ATP did and the PGA back in the day. So what we did is we did the natural thing as most startups nowadays is we went and raised money and brought venture capital. And so we have this unique model of co-investment and co-ownership between the athletes and some pretty phenomenal investors, the majority of one whom is Sir Michael Moritz.
And tell us about how the tour started and how it came together. What were the first events? How does that athlete body come together? And tell us about the journey you guys had. You guys have had several iterations, right? You had the Collins Cup as a starter anchor, and then you've also expanded, which we'll touch on quite a bit, I suspect, into creating a really cool media product, and also then doing participation so that amateur triathletes can compete alongside the professional triathletes in the races. So it's been a very interesting journey over those 6 or 7 years since the self-determination started. So take us a little bit through that.
And actually, probably I should start that, the history, as you say, so the journey we've been on, actually with the opening point with Mike Moritz and the investment, because why were we able to attract somebody like Sir Michael Moritz, obviously like one of the most famous venture capitalists of all time? This is a technology-focused podcast, so it's always fun to talk, you know, about the links that we have with Silicon Valley. And everyone naturally assumes that Mike must be a passionate triathlete, right? Because often with challenger brands like ourselves or challenger leagues, the first checks tend to be from, you know, passionate billionaires that are wanting to, you know, do that thing. Like you look at SailGP and the phenomenal job they're doing, you know, because Larry Ellison is just, you know, he loves sailing, right? And so he's helping transform that sport. In our case, Mike isn't a triathlete and has never been a triathlete. His interest in us is more of a traditional VC investment play, in that sport is a huge addressable market. So huge TAM, if we use, you know, the language of VC. It's pretty, without me being derogative to the sports industry in general, a lot of sport is quite archaic in its system. So that's also very attractive to venture capitalists, because they're used to disrupting, you know, industries. But then thirdly, specifically to triathlon, which I think is the most relevant reason, is triathlon has one, if not of the most valuable demographics in sport in terms of the participation base. So like I throw a couple of numbers out at you. The average household income of a long distance triathlete in North America is over $200,000. The last time it was polled, golf was about $125,000 in terms of household income. So you've got a sport that already over-indexes golf in terms of value. It's global, which is quite rare, right? Most sports, you know, there are obviously many global sports, but there are lots of sports that aren't. They're more national in focus, and it's been growing really fast. But despite those three different things, so like really valuable individually, growing, and global, from a commercial perspective, because the business model of triathlon before we came along was participation-based, it meant that actually by nature of the business, it was fragmenting its audience, right? So I'm in Australia, right? So if I use an Australian example, if it was the CMO of Qantas and they say, we've identified triathlon is the archetypal like user we want to be able to sell to, we're going to drop tennis and golf, we're going to focus on triathlon, they'd have to run around and like sign 100 different small sponsorship checks from all of these different groups to be able to consolidate an audience to be able to speak to. And, you know, with respect, no CMO in their right mind is going to go through that brain damage when they can call up the ATP or the PGA Tour, do it in one deal and reach those kind of audience. And so that's really sort of the underlying thesis of the PTO, is that we have this unbelievably valuable audience. It's totally fragmented. We have these incredible athletes that are superhumans in what they do. If we can plug the two together with a business model that involves media but isn't necessarily underpinned on media rights, there could be something interesting there. And that's why we were able to raise money from Mike and Warner Brothers and a few others.
And speaking about that specifically with Sir Michael Moritz, who is, as you said, a great venture capitalist and somebody who will have been looking at investments on the on a tech return level, right? How was the conversation with him around the business model of sports, how PTO could transform it, and what the expected returns were? Kind of to draw the parallels for us, because this is, whilst you guys do use a lot of technology, it is a rights play as opposed to kind of a, you know, a SaaS model or a deep tech development or something like that. So how did he look at that as an investment?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting wordy question. So if I think about unpacking a couple of different parts, this is classic VC in the case of it's, you know, capital at risk, but outsized returns should it succeed, right? So not the sort of most money, at least in my experience within sport, it tends to be mostly private equity, right? When we talk about investment in sport, private equity has become massive within the last 6 or 7 years. It's been institutionalized within sport, really. But VC hasn't, right? There's not that much early stage outside of sports tech. Right. And so there aren't too many challenger leagues like us that are raising money from venture capitalists. It's kind of a new model. And you know, the returns fit the VC model there of, you know, there are some reasonably high risk failure rates as these things get established, but then very outsized returns in the long run. So you're getting, you know, a 10 times return on your money instead of a sort of 3 to 4 times with private equity in contrast. So that's probably from the investment thesis, as it were. When it comes to technology, I mean, I remember this back to probably the opening meeting we had with Mike, was that one of his criteria was that he would invest provided we took a technology first approach to what we were doing. I won't be too derogative to the existing industry of what he said about it, but essentially that, look, it's in the dark ages. And so we've got to go and bring new technologies, new approaches to technology to the sport in order to sort of go and deliver its potential. And so we've always since said that. In fact, in he's bashful enough not to admit that this came directly from him, but I've always said that, you know, if you have someone of the level of Michael Moritz on your cap table or as a majority investor, there's no excuse but not to have the very best technology, right? Because who are we not to do that? And so I know this is, you know, a big part of what we're chatting about today. Technology has therefore been, and I should take a step back, I would say technology, but also Silicon Valley attitude in terms of the structure, whether it's the governance, incentive with athletes, the model that we take on how we operate. We've kind of tried to sort of bring Silicon Valley approaches to almost everything we do. And on the technology side, yeah, I mean, we could talk, I'm sure we will, in great detail, whether it's the broadcast product, whether it's fan data, participant engagement. We tend to group it mainly into those three buckets, right? There's sort of the product itself. There's how do we engage with the consumers that are not with us? And then there's participants, because as you pointed out, there is a participant play here. But to jump back to your question before on sort of the evolution, and it's been a really interesting journey to go through. So we spent sort of the first 3 years, I would describe, again, if I use technology phrase, proving product market fit, right? So seeing, could we actually do this, right? It's like, could triathlon become a real media product? Could we, A, get the athletes together? Can we get great venues? Can we make it work with sponsors? Like, is this just not going to be an economical model? We actually assumed when we first started this that this would be a YouTube, Facebook Live, OTT play, because clearly we believe in the value of our audience, but broadcasters, they're not going to give us the broadcast windows to be able to go and do this. And, you know, they're just traditional. And actually, we were really surprised in our first year, actually, the first event we did, the Collins Cup, we were live in 100 markets around the world on linear TV, 25 broadcast partners, which really took us by surprise. And where it really came from is when we went and met with broadcasters, their feedback was fairly consistent. They all loved triathlon as a sport. Like, they obviously have more data on their viewers and users than all of us ever will. And they've always said triathlon is a sweet spot for selling advertising. They really like it as a sport. The reason why it's not on television is that nobody's producing it with the production quality and values high enough that they're willing to give the airtime to it. Because obviously, if you're the distribution and programming director at Warner Brothers or any of these places, you've got pretty high risk when you're bringing on a new brand. Like, what if you put it on and the live feed breaks or the audio goes and all of these kind of different things, right? And so that was part of one of the most interesting surprises we had early on, is that the broadcasters and the B2B players, if we use that phrase, really bought into what we did. And now fast forward a few years, we have 32 broadcast partners. Our events are live in 190 markets, mixture of free-to-air, pay TV, in addition to an OTT solution. So that was kind of a surprise quite early on. Now that said, I'm sort of, the journey we went through initially was to establish the majors of triathlon. And we looked, again, very rational investment sort of eye at golf and tennis and said, those are our most comparable demographics. So let's look at those industries and see what's working, or look within those sports, sorry, I should say. And it's ironic what's happened with Saudi Arabia, but if you were to be in golf and if you were to buy anything in golf, actually, you probably wouldn't buy the PGA Tour. You buy the Masters, right? You go to Augusta. That would be the thing you could buy, if anything. Or if you use the tennis analogy, with the greatest respect to the ATP, you buy Wimbledon before you buy the ATP, if you look at the economics. And so our business model was exactly the same thing. We went and said, okay, let's establish four majors and the Collins Cup, which is a Ryder Cup sort of copycat or ripoff, depending on how nice you are to us. And those would be our five events, and we would be the Grand Slams. What we quickly realized, though, after about 18 months of, you know, establishing these, and we had a great success with an event in Singapore with the Asian Open, in talking to our broadcast partners, the feedback was, you guys are making great progress here. Like, you're proving out the economics. The viewership keeps going up. But if your goal is to take triathlon mainstream and to make the pros genuine, like, superstars, maybe not the level of, you know, Tiger Woods, but at least known in their markets, you're not going to do it with five events a year, you need to move to have traditional, I would say traditional, like a season-long narrative of a real tour. And that's really what the T100 is. So we spent about a year and a bit pivoting, for lack of a better word, around this new product, which we now launched six or seven weeks ago, which is the T100 Triathlon World Tour, which will take place in 10 iconic locations with the same athletes racing all day through the year. And I could spend at least 20 minutes going into detail on that. But that's kind of been the evolution of sort of learn the product, test, iterate, again, very Silicon Valley sort of style, get feedback from the key stakeholders, the athletes, the broadcast, the rest. And then now take what we hope is the product to market that will elevate triathlon to the level that it could be.
And so before we dive into kind of the tech application and how you use technology, and in fact, how you have used technology up until now, just give us a snapshot of what 2024 is going to look like with the T100, the majors, Collins Cup. Like, what's the mix going to be for the PTO?
Sure. So the T100, in fact, if we go even slightly greater detail, given the context of the podcast, like, it's the ingredients of, we basically looked at the sports industry and said, what are the key sort of the core tenets that work with different sports that sort of come together to make things strong? And we came up with seven, actually, and I'll try and do them from memory, given it's quite late here. Iconic locations. So being in amazing places, that was the first one. Consistent athletes. And so that's something we learned from doing our early events, is that we were putting events on and having great fields, but it wasn't consistent. Like, you'd have an amazing battle one weekend, and then we would do an event a month later, and one of those athletes would be there, but the other wasn't. And, you know, like, Formula One is Verstappen, Hamilton every weekend, right? And it's not suddenly NASCAR drivers or IndyCar drivers, right? You've got some consistency through the year. So that was really important. A season-long narrative. So actually a structure where it's not one-off events, where, like, we were, like, the Australian Open and Wimbledon, they were individual. Like, instead, you have a season-long competition that finishes at the end of the year, and adding prestige to that. So, like, how do you make it matter? So as you already talked about, we went to World Triathlon and said, look, we're going to create this tour. Why don't we do it with you rather than outside of the sporting ecosystem? Mm. And in return, we would like the prestige of being able to grant an official world champion. And so, like FIA with Formula One or FIA with Formula E, we are World Triathlon sort of recognized, and that gives the prestige for the athletes. So I think that's the fourth thing. Brand was the next. Like, we were originally called the PTO Tour. As anyone will know, if you're listening from America, PTO in the States means paid time off. And so, and maybe you don't know that, given you guys are both in the UK.
But I've never made the connection.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
In some parts of the world, you're the parent teachers organization. In the other parts of the world, you pay time off. And so from an SEO perspective, we were never going to win that fight. So that was probably the first reason. And then secondly, it links to the last part, which is mass participation. Mass participation was always very important to the strategy of triathlon. And we felt that actually, if you're launching a consumer-focused participation tour, calling yourselves professional is not necessarily the right name. And so that was the pivot to T100. 100 stands for the distance, because it's 2 kilometers, 80 kilometers, and 18. And the last one, and hopefully I've done, no, tech, which we'll talk about in great detail. And then the last one is mass participation festivals. So we now have triathlon, we have duathlon, we have swimming, cycling, running. So lots of different parts that go into basically creating a mass participation festival. And that means that we can have, you know, our event coming up in 3 weeks' time in Singapore. I think we've got just under 7,000 participants signed up. And that means a critical mass of about 15,000, maybe 20,000 on site. It's enough that you get that big event feel, which is important for both the people on site, but almost even more so the folks watching on TV. Because if anything that COVID showed us, sport without crowds, like, it's strange, but it just doesn't work, right? It doesn't matter what sport it is. Those were the six, plus tech, which I think we'll go into great detail. So it was a real journey from a business model and planning process. And what we've ended up with 2024 is we're doing 8 stages out of the 10, and we're in some pretty incredible locations. We were in Miami a few weeks ago. We're in Singapore in 2 weeks' time. We're then in San Francisco, London, Ibiza, Las Vegas, Dubai, and we're finishing up in the Middle East in a location we haven't quite announced yet, but we will soon. And so we're thrilled with those, like, about as bucket list as you could get as a world tour for, like, any sport. And so we're pretty excited about what it's going to mean.
Fantastic. Lots of fun stuff to come up. So let's dive into the tech component. And you talked a little bit about kind of how you guys focused on that, organically, but also through the direction of your investment, and Sir Michael Moritz. You also attracted investment from Warner Brothers Discovery, which is a huge, obviously, tick in the box, and they will have been very focused on that as well. How do you guys approach technology? Is it a tech-first approach? Do you see tech as an enabler to the stuff that you want to do and you go out and find what you need? Is it proactive? Is it reactive? Give us a little bit of a flavor for that.
Tech underpins everything we're doing because of we've needed it to, frankly, because this isn't a sport that has a lot of prestige or a history of like, this is how things were done. We've had to kind of make it up as we go along. And I would argue actually, even as a more sort of philosophical point, arguably this entire business model probably wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago, maybe even 5 or 6 years ago. Or I should say this in a different way. It would have been possible 10 years ago, but it would have been dramatically more capital intensive. And the reason being is one of the very big changes, of course, as we've seen, you know, the rise of direct-to-consumer technologies, the fact that the athletes themselves can have a direct relationship with consumers through social media. It's completely changed the way that a brand like us can launch. Now, that said, it's not to say that the B2B partners like a Warner Brothers aren't really important. And ironically, having said we didn't think we'd need them, they've become a real driver of the business. And as you said, we were in our Series B, we were thrilled that Warner Brothers, who were our largest partner, joined in the Series B. So Michael Moritz led the round. We had investment from a group called Divergent and Acuity, with two funds that sort of came along on the journey. And then Warner Brothers, which, you know, I think there's probably not a better validation of we can turn triathlon into a media product than having, I think, the third largest media company in the world on the cap table. So it was a really nice validation there. And again, sort of speaks to the value of the audience. But where it's ended up is sort of the technology we group it in is there's sort of the high profile areas, which is through broadcast. And then there's the less profile areas, which is sort of, you know, what's the nuts and bolts and pipes that we're using to go and do things, whether it's CDP or athlete engagement tools like Greenfly, which is, you know, yep, a phenomenal tool which we use, or even on the participant side. So one of the things about triathlon, as we mentioned, is a participation business. And we've really lent into that. That brings this sort of unexpected, wonderful benefit that most sports lack, which is that in fact, we'll have that this year, up to a year in advance, we will know the identities, the PII information of the people that are going to come to the event. Phenomenal, right? If you think about most ticketing-based businesses, they know very little about their fans because it's a transaction of X amount of tickets. Charlie, to your comment about the tickets you've just given your son for Wembley, right? Like, they don't know who you are. They don't know the age of your son. They don't know where you've lived. Potentially they know whether you live, but probably not because that data sits with Ticketmaster or, you know, some group like that. Whereas in contrast, we've got first party information up to a year in advance that, you know, Yanni is going to be doing a triathlon in London. He spent X amount of money.
Whoa.
Oh, this is the announcement of Yanni doing it then, right?
Again, whoa. But that is important, and it provides cash flow up front, right? Which is another hugely, hugely important and beneficial.
100%, yeah, from positive gearing perspective, yeah, the cash flow models and things like that. But I was more meaning even just the value and the data of knowing that someone has committed their time in a year in advance to do a physical activity that is going to require, obviously, their bodies, but also their minds and their wallets to do things. It brings a ton of data. But the industry at the moment, because the mass participation industry is, you know, it's not the most funded, it's not very lucrative, not a lot of margin. Most of the industry is not taking advantage of that data yet. And so one of the first things we've been doing is actually building our proprietary, we're obviously leveraging different software tools to do it, but our own CDP so that we can understand our customers better and understand their relationships with the various different things we can go and do with a view that we might not monetize media rights in the short term from a check from Warner Brothers, but to be fair, we are getting checks from various different folks, but not enough to sort of like make the business drive itself. But if we can consolidate that high value audience with first party data where we have more information than anybody else, there is a ton of value there that can be going created. And we've got a few other.
And are you approaching that out of curiosity from a media perspective to eventually try to get media checks? Are you approaching it from a sponsorship perspective to bundle it into sponsorship products? Or are you approaching it from a direct consumer perspective to actually become a sales organization or a marketing organization that's going to be able to capitalize on that first party data directly? How are you building those CDPs? How are you focusing on it? Or is it a mix of all of those?
Yeah, it's honestly all of the above. And this is where it gets so exciting, right? Is that once you have that level of data, you can then think about how you're going to go and use it and apply it, whether it is dramatically improving the commercial pitch for a sponsorship, because you can actually show, and I had this, I won't say the name of the company out loud, but I happened to be pitching an insurance group. I was able to show that in our Singapore event, we had 17 of their employees. And I knew 6 months in advance, right? And that was just an anecdotal example. We literally did it on the spot, logged into the system and said, look at this. Now, what if you extrapolate that about all of your target customers and the rest? So like, it's super interesting as a sponsorship tool. But where it also flows is to, so things like media rights, whether it's to inform a more structured OTT membership program. So we've just announced, I think if this goes out at the end of March, we will have just announced our partnership with Animoca Brands, which we're super excited about, which we think is going to be really, really innovative and different. So we can go into greater detail on what we'll be doing around Web3 in a second. But it's all underpinned from the data at the first place, right? If you know your fans, if you understand how they're engaging, then you can do an awful lot of things. And it's one of the areas where I wouldn't say the sports industry has been asleep at the wheel, because that's an unfair statement. Like, there are some people who are doing it very well, but I think at the macro level, there's a ton of upside here. And that's why, you know, institutional money is flooding into the space. And it's a validation of the value that's in this space. It just isn't being monetized yet.
And Sam, one of the things that's always struck me in mass participation is just the length of the training period running up to taking part in an event is long. And you've got this data, but so rarely it's actually being used to create an ongoing engagement piece. You've got lots of people doing training plans, but often they're doing it off either a piece of paper or an app that's a total third party that's nothing to do with it. Does this give you an opportunity to really create a long-term engagement with somebody who's coming to the event?
Exactly. And that's sort of a very natural segue to what we're doing with Animoca. So Animoca recently announced, in fact, I think, I don't know if it's even that public that they're doing it, but they've launched a subsidiary called Sports Pass that we're working with. And it's very much around fan and membership engagement, that they're working with bodies that have, you know, a large user base like ourselves, and saying, look, not only the CDP and the first party data part, but like, how are you actually engaging with those customers and what do you know about them? And this is where blockchain becomes pretty interesting, about how, you know, I don't want to go off on too much on sort of, you know, the buzzwords of NFTs and things like this. This is more about, that's being derogative, I shouldn't be unfair. I didn't mean it as like, we're not selling images of athletes. It's that you take the underlying technology that's in blockchain. It's perfect for the sports organization. And to their credit, Animoca Brands recognized this quite a while ago. And so what I mean by that is the ability for, as an individual level, to have a ton more information about our users, but also for our community to be able to have a ton more information about themselves, link that with us officially, and then create, ultimately, at the simple level to describe it, a membership product, but a membership product that includes training data, the journey that they've been on, incentives around, if we know that Yanni's clearly doing the London Tri now and in a year's time, we know that he's going to have to travel there on that day. So maybe we should give him an incentive for Southwest Rail. You know, there's all these different things that can come from having the information. But there's one thing to have the data. A second is to have the consumer tool to be able to use it. And that's where Animoca comes in. So we're super early on the journey, but we're really excited that, especially, you know, like, let's call it what it is, triathlon is a niche sport. You know, we're not the NFL, we're not the NBA. And so we're thrilled to be working with a leader like Animoca Brands to come in and do this. And one of their interests with us, without me being unfair to speak on their behalf, is that because we are a more innovative, fast-moving group, we're able to test out some membership and participation models here that they can then extrapolate to much bigger sports. And so hopefully this becomes the part of a really interesting change in how people engage with participation sports.
Unpack that bit that you mentioned just now, also about triathlon not being being a niche sport and sort of not being on the level of media consumption of, you know, basketball, football. How have you guys approached that? And at the very beginning, you were very much focused on creating a media product. The T100 is part of that as well. And then how do you use, as part of that, and I know this is a big question, but as part of that, how do you look at technology and how's Warner Brothers helping with that in order to tell the story of the races in a different way and engage with the audience whose consumption habits are changing?
Yeah, no, look, such a great segue into what is our biggest focus from a technology perspective, which is ultimately the product itself, right? And in that, sport is storytelling always, right? Always. It's all about the journeys that the athletes go through, the drama, the intrigue, the athleticism of what they're doing. But that's just hasn't been done in triathlon yet. Or I should say, that's being a little bit unfair. It happens, but it happens every 4 years around the Olympic Games, right? There's a ton of interest around the Olympics in the athletes. And that's why the Brownlee brothers are household names in the UK because of the Olympics and the momentum you get. But like most Olympic sports, after that sort of cycle drops, it kind of goes off because there isn't as much investment and focus on it. So our first part around the content and broadcast was about how do you tell the stories of the athletes? And that's really about two things. And one of these we haven't really perfected yet, but we're getting close, and we hope this year we'll be able to pull it all together. The first is just a good old-fashioned content storytelling, understanding who the athletes are, telling their stories, whether it's short form, whether it's long, you know, just getting their personalities out there. And that's just a process to go through, right? It's been tried and tested in so many sports. We were fortunate to recruit some fantastic people from, like, my head of content, Nick, came from the UFC, so really adept at doing those kind of things. We've got folks from the ATP, from Formula One, who've sort of understood how to do it. That's maybe a more obvious thing that we're doing. The less obvious and the far more challenging thing we've had to do, which is you can't just sort of put cameras on triathlon and turn it into a TV sport and think it'll work like with a click of your fingers, because like any sport, you need to be able to understand contextually what the athletes are doing. And just with a camera on them, you can't do that, right? And I would say that actually the case with most sports outside of maybe team and bull sports, like if I take Formula One, right, it's on this weekend in Albert Park down here. If Formula One was on without any data, it would be boring as anything, right? Like, no, you just see cars going around for 2.5 hours. Maybe there might be a crash without sounding crass, like that gets people excited. But outside of the data and the storytelling of understanding that Norris is 0.7 down and now he's 0.6, 0.5, and what's the engines doing and the rest, that's what makes it engaging. And so that is exactly the journey that we're on, you know, and Warner Brothers is helping us on that, is how do you apply that approach to human athleticism, which is one of the reasons why we very much position the T100 Tour as the Formula One of the fitness industry, that we have these highly tuned, I was about to say engines, they're athletes, right? They're the highly tuned engines of the athletes. So it's linking that to the cars, right? We have, and we would argue that the athletes now in triathlon, they stand at the absolute pinnacle of human endurance, right? In fact, if I use an example, she's world number three at the moment, Lucy Charles Barkley from the UK, I mean, narrowly missed qualifying for the 1500 meters in the Olympics recently, as in the Olympic trials. She was second in the trials, and she's a triathlete. She just dropped in to do the swim as part of her training. We have a triathlete called Cam Worth, who's on Team Ineos. So like he does the UCI Grand Tour rides and then goes for a bike ride afterwards and does a triathlon the weekend after. Like the athleticism has reached, like this is absolutely superhuman. But unless you're really close to the sport, if you see that on TV, you don't get that, right? Because you're just seeing athletes go round and round. And so long winding answer to your question, like one of the things we've been having to do and investing to do so is to create the technology that we can get the data in real time and serve it up in the broadcast so that we can engage beyond the human storytelling to the athleticism of what they're doing. And that's things like time gap. I mean, it's really basic stuff, but it's just been lacking in endurance sports.
And it's that things like putting monitoring and chips on the bikes, monitoring on the athletes, I guess, how do you do that in water? Or are you looking at more, say, camera-based technologies as well, that you're not necessarily using the sort of the things that are wearables or directly on the bikes and the athletes themselves?
It's both. And so actually, if I take a step back, because it's quite amazing when you have sort of conversations like this to realize quite how poor the technology is in a lot of these sports, even in the Olympic Games, in triathlon, and I believe in road running still, you're only getting timing updates or results updates when an athlete has run across a timing mat, right? So as I'm sure you know what I mean, most people who have listened to this have done a race, and sometimes you wear a chip in your shoulder, on your ankle, and you run across it. But that is, our head of television, our head of broadcast, came from Formula One. He was 22 years with Formula One, a fantastic guy called Martin Turner. And one of the first things he said to me when he heard this was like, well, that's like watching tennis and getting the score after every fourth shot. Like, how on earth does that work, right? We need to know what's happening in real time. Like, this is terrible. And yet, even at the Olympic Games, that's how it works. So the first thing, Charlie, what we've been doing to answer your question is, yes, go and get biometric devices that the athletes can wear that give us not only heart rate or temperature and things like that, but even a more basic thing is, like, actually, where are they? Like, GPS of real-time location, so that you can then extrapolate an accurate time gap. Is it increasing? Is it decreasing? How fast are they going? And that all comes from GPS. But I mean, I was surprised to find it when we launched this, but like this stuff doesn't exist, right? We've had to go and work with partners from outside other sports and even outside the industry. And in fact, the solution which we're working through at the moment, I won't say the name of the company because it's still sort of being worked through, but it's actually from horse racing. So we've actually sort of, we've tried various iterations of this and ended up with a tool that is being used very in most of the largest horse races in the world as the GPS tracker. And we found that has got the level of accuracy that we need that can then, you know, give us the data we need to be able to go and then fuel the graphics and all the rest, which is sort of the downstream technology impact. But if you don't have the data in the first place, you really struggle. And so that's really where our focus is at the moment.
And how do you bring that into, say, the broader storytelling? Because one of the things that you often see is it's fine having the data, but unless the commentators know how to tell the story on the back of the data or the messages that can come through, it's no use. So have you had to almost find a whole new set of commentators, or how's that worked for you?
So we're on that journey. We're by far from perfect yet. And one of the things that sort of I would say nice about the approach here is like, this is not an overnight thing, right? It's not like we flick a switch and we've made triathlon into Formula One. Like this will be a 3-5 year journey of twisting and iterating and off we go. It's a combination of, let me think the right way of describing it. It's, we refer to it actually as being sort of contextually relevant data. So we could have, as what you're saying, basically, Charlie, right? Like we could show wattage in real time and power and things like this, but it's not relevant to like 99% of the audience. And so that actually has no space in our graphics, right? Where it has a space is in a second screen solution, where if you're a super fan and you want to know what power Sam Long is pushing in real time, great, but go to the website, go to our app and go and get that. And we work with We Are Sweet, which is a fantastic company, been helping us sort of figure that piece out. But that's different to the what you want to have on the screen, which is more around something that people can understand. So heart rate, we all hopefully have one of those. if we're talking, and so generally we can all relate to, oh my goodness me, like Lucy Charles's heart rate has been 118. It's been there for 20 minutes. She's going to keel over, right? It's that, those kind of things which are, you know, immediately human, but also, and it sounds so basic, but even time gaps, right? And actually knowing that this athlete is 35 seconds from athlete two, now it's 20 seconds, now it's 15. I mean, it sounds so incredibly basic compared to other sports, but it's lacking in endurance sports until we put this together. And once you have that, then you can really tell a story, right? As opposed to, oh, we think they're in the lead, we're going to get an update soon, which is how, you know, marathons and triathlons and most endurance sports work until we've come along.
And you mentioned before about sort of telling the story of the athletes, and you mentioned Lucy Charles Barkley, who I have to admit before this, I watched a video with her on it, and she's incredibly eloquent, obviously an amazing athlete. Then I Googled her, and then I realized how good she was, like yeah. off the scale good. Yeah. But I'd never heard of her until that. So how, and I'm specifically thinking from a technology point of view, how do you go about building the profile of these athletes? Because lots of people say, I mean, I remember doing some work for the NFL a long time ago, said, oh, we need to build the profile of the athletes within the UK. Everybody says we need to build the profile of the athletes, but how are you actually doing it? And how are you using the technology to help you do so as well?
So there's a couple of different ways to answer this. There's the first is the direct relationship with the athletes and helping them with creating original content and then getting it out to as many places as possible, because it's just a, you know, content play. And actually, if I use an example that he's now retired, he's our commentator, but it's a good articulation of where we see the potential here is there's an athlete called Jan Frodeno, who if you haven't heard of Lucy Charles, I certainly wouldn't expect you to have heard of Jan Frodeno, but he is arguably the GOAT of triathlon. He's won the Olympic Games. He's won the Ironman World Championships multiple times. And twice out of the last 5 years, he's also won German Sports Personality of the Year. And the reason why that's interesting, right, as I can see as you react, is that that's him as an individual athlete without really any infrastructure or support behind him. And if we think about in Germany, that means probably he's beaten a professional footballer. And that footballer will have had the Bundesliga behind them. They would have had an agent. They would have an infrastructure. They might have had Bayern Munich, right? There's a whole ecosystem around the footballer. And yet the individual triathlete has managed to cut through and win. And so the reason I mention that is it's one of the things we sort of share with the investors. If you imagine if Jan had an organization like us that's got an active communications team, they have a social media team, they have relationships with the media telling the stories, you're just going to naturally improve their chances of getting cut through. So it's kind of three different areas. There's an organizational side. There's the direct technology of things like Greenfly, of getting athletes' content in real time. So if we use Alistair Brownlee a couple of weeks ago, we were getting him, or I should say his agent, live clips of him racing in real time for his social media to go live. Right. So that's like just so far ahead of being able to get engagement. And I would love us to get to the point where our athletes are broadcasting our content in real time, right? On Instagram Live and things like that. Like, we have the rights. So why would we not embolden our athletes as broadcasters themselves? Now, obviously there's, you know, we have relationships with folks, so it's hard to do with, you know, have contracts and things like that, but we can see that's where the sport's going and we're the kind of folks that can do it. The third one though is a bit more of a traditional answer, and it plays back into the business model, is the way you get cut through, you may wake them stars, and this is not an overnight thing, is you get media companies to recognize the value and to tell the stories. Like, we could shout as the PTO from the rooftops all day long about what, how wonderful these athletes are, and, you know, it's going to be a blip in the ocean. If we can get Warner Brothers and the BBC and Fox Sports and the rest recognizing it, and we do that by creating a product that they can use in a good way with lots of sort of supporting stuff around it in a season-long narrative, that's how we begin to get cut through. So it really goes back to I know that was a long answer, but the T100 is the actual answer. We hope that this won't be overnight, but it provides the platform that broadcasters can sort of buy into the sport and ultimately promote those champions. And we know it works because it works with the Olympic Games every 4 years. It's just that we have to create the coverage between those Olympic gaps, that there's enough content and opportunity to tell those stories so that Lucy is recognized as she walked down the high street, which she's beginning to be so, actually. Like, it's starting to get there. I think she's got just shy of a million followers already, and she's growing like crazy, and she's an example of the superstar. But, you know, the stuff takes time and it takes energy and it takes focus, and hopefully that's what we're bringing to the table.
How many triathletes make a living out of triathlon alone? How many of them have enough of a following that they can become content, make content revenues themselves? Do you understand what I'm saying? So there's triathlon, there's prize money, there's sponsorships for wearing a patch, but then you can also generate your own revenue streams by being an influencer and generating content. And how do you see the central organizations, the PTO's responsibility in helping to foster that and kind of help your triathletes find other sources of revenue beyond just the participation in the traditional sponsorship within triathlon?
Yeah. So look, to answer the first part of the question, I have to use some data points to answer it. Before we started, one of the reasons we were started, as we said, is the athletes got together because they weren't being compensated well enough. Amazingly, although triathlon is this global sport that's got very valuable sports entities to the rest, unless you placed fourth in the world championships at Ironman, you lost money. That's how bad the prize money was.
Wow.
Right. So yeah, crazy, right? And what I mean by that is, I think it's like $8,000 or $9,000 for fourth. But if you factored in, you had to fly to Hawaii, you're staying for a week, you're taking a physio, you were losing money in this, right? Fast forward to us now, and I should know this number off the top of my head, but I'm going to say it's the 18th place person. So basically, almost everybody who does the T100 will make a minimum $100,000 a year. So we've sort of got it to the point where, you know, they're not taking private jets yet, but like, that's a real living, able to go and grow. So that's probably how the sport has evolved. And, you know, it's us driving it, but to their credit, Ironman have put up their prize money dramatically over the last 2 years since we came along. They put in an extra $2 million. It was a huge jump over the last year. So we're thrilled to see that. And there's a group called Super League that does short distance triathlon that's done the same and put prize money up. So we're really seeing a momentum now since we sort of come along and got the flywheel going. And at the end of the day, that's what the organization is here to do, right? The athlete's body. So if we can see prize money inflation, then we know that we're doing a good job for our members. When it comes to content creation and the rest, yeah, I wouldn't know the number off the top of my head of where's the cutoff of followers that you can monetize it directly. What I do know is that one of the things I sort of look at, and I really do believe this, is that although several of the athletes have their own sort of content teams, to me, partly that's the job of the PTO to come and help with, because we want our athletes focused on being the most superhuman phenomenal that they are, not necessarily having to think about creating YouTube videos, right? And so there's sort of an in-between there that we need to facilitate it and help it. Obviously, it's how sports evolved. But this is not a mature enough sport that, like, these are professional footballers who have a team of four content providers following them around all day long, right? And so we want them focused on the athleticism, and we can help them get the stories out and do that, which is what we have a team that's doing.
Sam, I just want to take you back to the comments you made earlier about the sponsors and how you build up the sponsorship piece. And it was actually on the video I was watching with Lucy earlier. She actually talked about the need to bring non-endemic sponsors in. I was looking at the PTO website, all the sponsors that are listed there, we've got an official goggles supplier, an official bike supplier. They are very much the brands that are associated with actually taking part in the triathlon. How do you view that sort of journey to bringing in the non-endemic sponsors, so your airlines, your car manufacturers, people like that? And what's the role in technology and data, and also activation opportunities that are often tech enabled in enabling you to go and talk to those, let's call them bigger brands, and bring them in?
So kind of a couple of different things. It really speaks back to actually, and this is where we're fortunate we're able to do this, but it's also like underpinned from the business model. This is why we raised money, right? So we kind of looked at this and said, there's clearly an opportunity here. If we consolidate this audience, there's a lot of value. There's an awful lot of sponsorship money that's flowing around. Let me give you a number. $1.6 billion is spent by non-endemic brands in golf, right? So, and that's by brands that want to associate themselves with that high value golf audience, which is an almost identical one to triathlon in a very, very cluttered, busy market, right? The HSBCs, the Alliances, everybody, the rest. There's a huge opportunity there as a TAM, but we have to go and have the product to be able to sell to them first. And so that's really where VC comes in, right? That's where the burn rate comes from, is that we're building the property. It's the classic, you know, build it and they will come. What we did in the short term is clearly the endemics, it's different, right? They get it straight away. They want to be associated with us. And so we've got wonderful endemic partners that sort of bought in early on, but we've purposely underwritten not having title sponsorships for the first 2 to 3 years, mainly because we don't want to undersell it. And I could probably walk in within reason into sort of many of sort of businesses in the UK and sell a sponsorship for maybe $100,000 or $200,000 for title sponsorship. But that would be so undervaluing the properties compared to the comps in tennis and golf and Formula One and the rest, that we're building up the T100 first, and then we're going to go to market and get in non-endemics, which is what we've just started doing. And so we are, I hope, where we are on 22nd of March, we are weeks away, if not days away, from announcing our first major non-endemic partner, which will be the title of a couple of our events. It's actually a technology business, interestingly enough. And they've come on board because they recognize the value in our audience and they want to be able to engage with them. That obviously is underpinned by the CDP and the data and the technology we mentioned, that we can show that if we have an event in Singapore, we had, you know, this 1,000 people that were this demographic and this is where they work and all the rest. And that way you serve it up for them as a fan base or an audience.
So, Sam, what's next? You guys are, you know, you guys are have taken some huge steps. You've got the T100 that's launching this year, and you will crown a world champion at the end of the season. What do you see as the next steps in the medium to long term?
Well, and it's medium, short, long. It is really the T100, like, and we really believe that. Like, it's taken us a couple of years to sort of figure out the right model, but we think now with this 10-stage world tour, and a couple of locations might change, so obviously there's some work that goes into that, but we think we've got the right business model here that's unique in its offering. It's a bit of a white space that we've come into, that when I describe this to investors, I always sort of talk about it that we're kind of a mixture of three. We're like the PGA Tour from a governance structure, because we've got the athletes and the pros. We're Formula One with this sort of season-long glamorous locations, and we're the World Marathon Majors with this mass participation. And, you know, like the London Marathon, New York Marathon, these are amazing businesses, and they're part of the World Marathon Majors, but that's a 6 different organizations. With us, we're one, right? And we're consolidating that. So really it's a super exciting journey that, I wouldn't be as arrogant enough to say that we can be valued the same level as Formula One in, you know, 15 or 20 years, but that's certainly the ambition, right? Like, is to create a, you know, multi-billion dollar sports property from the nature of what we've created here with, and it's back to athlete storytelling. There's an existing audience here. We just need to consolidate them through the T100 tour. And so, we're pretty excited, as you can probably tell, even though it's gone 10 p.m. here, I'm still energized from talking about it, because it's pretty rare for a sport to get to sort of retransform and rethink about it when you've got the right capital with hopefully the right strategy and some phenomenal athletes. And so I would say watch this space. It's going to be, we've got to go execute now and deliver on all of it, but we've had our first few and it's gone well, and we're excited about rolling it out and ultimately taking triathlon mainstream so that everyone has heard of Lucy, Charlie.
There we go. And final question then, and this wasn't on the prep notes, by the way, so sorry for throwing it at you at 10 p.m., but I'm fascinated. What's your dream tech solution? Like, what problem are you facing right now that you would love to have a technology solution to just be like, let's figure this out?
Look, I'm so in the weeds with the one that we're doing at the moment. It would be an extension of what we've got. So the equestrian device, working fully with all of the relay tools. But there's one extra step which we would love to do is I'd love to be able to have the scale economics to roll that out to the amateur market as well, because that would be really cool, right? So like, and that is very much an intention that we're going to work towards, that not only do the, so I sort of play it out in real time, that the athletes are obviously using it to get all of the data and they have performing and the rest, and we're getting that into our broadcast, but then offering that as a service to all of the mass participants in the world, consolidating all that data into our membership platform, that could get pretty exciting, right? Like that's like Strava on speed. And so Strava with speed, I suppose, ultimately.
when I'm racing the London Triathlon, I can have a little voice in my ear saying, if you go 1 kilometer per hour faster, you're going to be able to catch Charlie at the finish line, kind of thing.
Exactly. Or another way of saying it, you are now 50 kilometers behind Lucy Charles. You're now 60 kilometers behind Lucy Charles.
I don't think I'll be doing it, let alone competing with Lucy Charles Barkley. All right.
Well, listen, we mentioned it in our podcast. I think it's inevitable now, no?
Jeez. What am I signing up for? Well, on that note, and before I go off and cry into my milk, I would like to say a huge thank you to both my fabulous co-host Charlie and Sam for joining us. What a fantastic conversation. Hope we can do it again soon. To those of you listening at home, please do make sure to give us a like and a subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Go to our website, sportsloft.co, and sign up for our newsletter. And make sure to follow us at sportsloft.co. HQ on social. So a big thank you to Charlie, thank you for very competently guiding me in my meandering ways through this podcast, as ever.
Meandered so well, mate.
And Sam, thank you for making the time and joining us from dark but inevitably sunny Australia, and good luck with everything as it moves forward. We're very excited to see where it goes. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure. Like a fun conversation. It's easy to get passionate about this. It's an exciting journey, but it's always great to talk about it and look forward to charting our journey over the next few years. You know, it's going to take some time and some effort, but we've got the will and the capital to hopefully make something pretty exciting here.
Brilliant. Well, instead of competing in the T100 in London, maybe we can do a live podcast around it or something like that. How's that? All right. Great. Well, to all our listeners, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time in the Sports Loft. Goodbye.